This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. When Damon Tweedy was in his first year of medical school, he learned a number of startling statistics, and they all seemed to lead him back to the same conclusion. Being black is somehow bad for your health. He heard that black patients were faring far worse than others in almost every field of medicine, but nobody seemed to be talking about why. As his career evolved, he also began to notice the number of ways in which his own race was helped and impacted by the relationships with patients and their own healthcare experience. He documented the experiences and grappling with racial identity and health of black Americans in a recent New York Times piece. He also has an upcoming memoir, A Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Damon Tweedy is a professor of psychiatry at Duke University and a staff physician at Durham VA Medical Center, and he joins me in the studio now. Damon Tweedy, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Take us back to those early years, deciding to go to medical school, going to Duke Medical School. Did race play much of a factor? Did you think it was going to have much of an impact on you as a medical student?
I didn't, actually. I started off, the journey starts in Maryland. I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C. area. And I grew up in an all-black working-class community. And my parents hadn't gone to college. I did have an older brother who did go to college. And that was really sort of an inspiring thing for me. In high school, I tested into a magnet program that had a large number of Asian and white students. It was predominantly that mix. And it was there that I really began to think about the idea of becoming a doctor. So when I got to medicine, to medical school, I really certainly didn't have any notions of racial justice or racial disparities. I was really just thinking about, wanting to become a cardiologist and unclogging arteries. So the idea that I would be talking about race and medicine was something that really, is surprising to me looking back on it.
Because you're going to med school in the 1990s, right?
Yes, 1996 is when I started.
So you start med school at Duke, and your parents, you point out, that went to segregated schools, or at least one of your parents did. Yes. So it's in your background, but by 1996, you're really pretty convinced that all I have to do, I'm getting good grades, I'm at a good med school, I'm on my way. What happened?
So in that first year of medical school, you learn about all the different assortment of diseases, heart disease, cancer, diabetes. And professors, they would always initially start off by talking about the biological dimensions of these disorders. But then towards the end of the lecture, they'd bring up some of the more social or demographic factors. And it seemed like they were always had these two refrains. One was X disease is more common in black people. And the second one was this disease, if for black people who have this disease, they have far worse outcomes. And often they would say both factors would apply to any given disease. And so you had this was on and on every lecture. I could feel it coming, and you just started internal feeling of dread. And it kind of drained you to hear this because you kind of wonder, because they didn't really address the next question, which was why. Why was this so? It was just so they lay these facts out there just for you to memorize on an exam. But to me, it meant so much more than that. And really, it took on even these theoretical things took on a personal dimension when towards the end of my first year of medical school, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure or hypertension, which is one of those diseases that's more common in black people and has worse outcomes in black people.
Were you surprised to find out that you had high blood pressure?
Yes. I mean, I had a family history of high blood pressure. My grandmother actually had died early in my first year of medical school, and she had hypertension for a long time, and she suffered heart failure and stroke related dementia, which was also a complication of high blood pressure. But she was in her late 60s, early 70s. I was a young guy in my early 20s, very fit, so really wasn't on my radar. And then I really began to reckon with the fact that the diet that I was eating was playing a huge part in that. And so that's part of what I had to deal with.
It's one of the personal stories that brought home some of these statistics to you, but there's another story that you tell about walking into a classroom as a student and being misunderstood as somebody else.
Yeah, there are actually a handful of incidents like that occurred during medical school. There were times when you'd come into a patient room, for instance, and you'd have on your white coat and your stethoscope, and the patient would come. The patient would ask you to. Or not as a patient, but some of the staff members at the hospital to take the tray up of the patient or to bring them coffee. Things that are just really like, wow, I'm here trying to learn to be a doctor, and this is sort of where things are. But then there was also an incident as a first year medical student where I walked into a classroom, and there was an older white professor, and he mistook me for the person that was there to fix the lights in the room. And he was pretty, you know, strident about it. He's like, well, you know, I called about this. Why are you late? And it's pretty funny looking back on it. If you think about it, for me, I'm the opposite of a handyman. So in my own home, we have a light that's been out for several months, and I still haven't gotten around to fixing that. So just the idea of that is pretty ironic. But certainly those are some things that I dealt with.
And the way to get back to him was to try to fix the light, actually. Apparently, that's what you're saying. If you had tried to fix the light, that would have gotten him, because that wouldn't have been fixed for years. But it is a serious concern. And,
sure,
of course,
absolutely.
These things are happening to you in the 1990s, right. and you're also grappling with these disturbing statistics. So when did you decide to look into, you know, what are the causes and what could be done about it?
Well, as a second-year student at Duke, you go out into the clinical the world, and you really start to see patients out in the community, at the hospital, in different settings. And really, there were like three different ways in which I was seeing this play out, you know, sort of over and over again. And so there were these system or structural level factors that played out. For instance, Black people were more likely to be in residential areas where they were segregated, and less access to good medical care, less access to doctors, particularly specialists. I mean, that was a big issue. One thing that comes to mind, we were in a community, we went out to a community about an hour and a half from Duke, and you just saw these patients, it's like a charity clinic, all the patients are Black, most of them do not have health insurance, and they have these problems that could be, that you could treat very differently. It's like what you could do for them was very substandard as compared to what might, you know, happen to that same person were at Duke, for instance. And it was really striking to see that, you know, just an hour away, how different, you know, the medical care could be and how it disproportionately impacted Black people. So that was really one aspect of things that I saw. Another side of it was this whole idea of how the doctor and the patient communicated and issues of trust. I mean, and there's a long history in our country of how, Black patients have been denied treatments, been experimented upon without their consent or awareness. I mean, this is really sort of unfortunate dark history that dates back to the past. And while things have improved considerably, of course, that still impacts the way many Black people view the healthcare system, and so and doctors' advice. So that's a really important role as well. And I think the third thing that I discovered was just that there are significant sort of cultural, it's sort of related to the second point, but the cultural factors in terms of the diet and exercise, and also just the attitudes towards health and wellness that differ, and also affect outcomes.
How much of this were you noticing on your own? Because I think there's been a fair amount written about what we would now call cultural competency, understanding the nature and the culture of people who you're working with. Again, some of the history and some of the suspicion that has grown up over the years for very good reason. How much of that had you read about, and how much of it was now coming to you just through personal experience?
Vast majority of it came through personal experience. I mean, you would, as far as cultural competency, you'd have a lecture, a couple hours, but you can't learn that history and really give proper context of that in a 2-hour, you know, lecture. So it really was much more about the sort of day in and day out interactions with everyday Black people and sort of seeing the struggles that they faced.
What about, you are a psychiatrist, and that's obviously a specialty. Are things any different? Are they more difficult when it comes to psychiatry and mental health?
In some ways, it's actually worse in mental health, I think, or more challenging. I think there are really two reasons for that. Part of it is because the way that psychiatry is funded compared to historically been funded, and you'd often really have this two-tiered system that's evolved of public care, public sector care versus private sector care. It's there in all areas of medicine, but in some ways it's more stark in psychiatry. And so often you see two patients with the exact same problem, and what would happen is that they have two very different paths of treatment which they go upon, which are very different. And it would really come down to, you know, this financial. It's a lot about social class, but all too often that social class difference played out along racial lines. And so that was something that was really stark that I would see. And then I think the second aspect of that, as far as psychiatry goes, is that, you know, that's a very personal subject matter that occurs. The patient's talking about the most private and, you know, moments in their lives and difficult things that they discuss. It's very different than maybe talking about a broken foot. And so they're talking about these really, personal issues, and often there's the relationship between the doctor and the patient takes on even greater importance. And a lot of times I would find that Black patients were coming in and they would request a Black provider. We think about the demographics of our area, you know, Durham County and the surrounding counties, it's a very large Black population. But in psychiatry, we have very few Black providers. And so there is this clear mismatch in terms of, you know, delivering the services that the patients were often needing.
And how important is that? First of all, talk about the disparity in providers, not just psychiatry, but in medicine in general, in terms of if I wanted to have an African-American doctor, that's a little more difficult too, right? just because of the numbers.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the general population, the African-American population is about 13% in total, you know, nationwide. Within the medical community, it's about 5%. And that's – and if you think about a lot of this concentrated in certain geographic areas, but nation, I mean, a lot in the South, but nationwide, the numbers are really low.
Is this something that would be, that could be at least answered or addressed through more cultural competency training? In other words, if more white doctors understood this, you know, that might solve part of the problem. Or is this really a question of a kind of confidence that can only happen between an African-American doctor and patient?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that there are many cases where cross, you know, interracial doctor-patient relationships can flourish, and both sides can really have a lot of personal growth from it. So I wouldn't say that the goal of care is to have every black patient have a black doctor. But I think it's nice to have that choice for patients who that becomes a really important issue for them. So, I mean, that's how I would say that.
Yeah, one of the things in medicine that, you know, we've seen this over and over again as well, that a lot of the research studies are done and there are very few people of color who participate in them for a variety of reasons, many having to do with trust. But that means some of the results are different. They may not apply as well to communities of color. And the treatments are different, that there are some treatments that are more effective and less effective in communities of color. I mean, talk about the importance of knowing that and then being able to apply that in your practice.
Well, I think historically that's been very much the case, that many times black people were in research, were being researched, research studies, were not knowing they were actually in a research study. You know, they were being experimented upon without their awareness. And so that's really built up a huge reservoir of mistrust. And I think that's – so historically it's been hard for researchers to often get black people into studies. I think that's – I think the tides are changing. And I think that's improved considerably. For instance, at Duke, you know, there's a – many years ago – there was a study from the DASH diet, which is a study looking at dietary interventions to help hypertension. And in that particular study, for example, they oversampled the number of black people. So the percentage of black subjects was greater than sort of the what you would expect from the general population. And that was really helpful because, you know, it really helped validate some of the findings that they had in that study. So I think researchers are trying to be more cognizant of that, particularly in diseases like hypertension and diabetes that really disproportionately afflict black people.
You know, our earlier conversation about terrorism, particularly as it has an impact on communities of color, African-American experience in the United States, history with lynching terrorism, this has a kind of cultural trauma, historic trauma. Is this something that you pay attention to? But I think the bigger question is, do practitioners in general have enough credibility in the impact of this to actually see it as a thing and treat it as such, or see that it might be part of what's going on with the person?
Yeah, I think some do, but certainly some don't, and that's something, an area where there needs to be further improvement. And I think if you have a patient in your exam room and they're not, you know, quote, doing what they're supposed to do, often there's this label of being noncompliant and, you know, this sort of pejorative labels. But I think the important thing is to try and get to the below that surface and really approach it, rather than lecture the patient that, you know, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. Really say, well, you know, I can see we're not meeting our goals that we have for you. What might be getting in the way of it? And so then that may uncover some of those sort of hidden issues.
And you cite cases too that where race is somehow a part of the issue here, and even with an African American patient talking to you, an African American doctor, you have to kind of get to that it doesn't bubble up, but it does become relevant to their treatment.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there was one patient, but there have been several actually, but one that comes to mind is an older gentleman, and I wrote about this in a New York Times article, who came in with depression, and, you know, sort of, you know, depression is this broad label. And only after talking with him more did it really come up that it was really a lot about sort of his sense that the black community where he had lived and raised his children had declined considerably. And so we really got him talking more about the past. And, you know, and even if he couldn't fix all the larger problems, there was still room for him to make some difference. And that really was really what he needed, you know, rather than, say, the traditional approach of prescribing, you know, an antidepressant medication. So it's really getting to the layer below.
So you can see how that might be easier, even though it took a little time. It might be easier for him to talk to you, a black doctor. But that doesn't mean, from all that you've said and written, that other doctors, that white doctors, can't get to this and understand that may be here and figure out a way to get to that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, even me, in my experience treating white patients, there's that same sort of cross-racial, dynamic. But and so there were many cases. One I think of in particular, there was a younger white man, and you know, on the surface it seemed like we had almost nothing in common. You know, he was very much a sort of pickup truck, motorcycle, you know, NASCAR kind of guy, and that's just completely different from me. But you know, we were able to really find common some real piece of common ground when he started to talk about his family, and he talked about the relationship with his father, which in some ways was similar to the one I had with my own dad. And so you're able to find these pieces of, despite these huge differences, you're able to find this piece of common ground, and we were able to, you know, establish a really great relationship. So I think that there's no reason why a white doctor treating a black patient can't do that same thing, and I think that's the goal.
You're putting your finger on sort of the importance of narrative and understanding stories, your own and other people's stories. How important was that in medical school when you were going, and do you think things are changing now, that the understanding how to perceive narrative, how to interpret narrative, is it more important in medicine today?
I think it's an ongoing struggle. I mean, I think there are certainly many people who recognize that it's an important issue, but it goes up against this. There's still this sort of race to learn about the science, because you have to know the medicine, right. And there's more and more information that keeps coming out, and so there's always this pressure of, well, what can we give these medical students in this narrow amount of time that they have? But I think that there is an acknowledgement, increasingly so, that story and narrative is vitally important. I mean, that you can't be a good doctor just on the science alone. You have to be able to relate it to that person.
It's great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Damon Tweedy is a psychiatrist and a writer. He has a forthcoming memoir called A Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Should come out in September anyway. You can find out more about him and about the book and all we've talked about by going to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director, Andrew Tai, the intern, and Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.